From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Governor Gretchen Whitmer and legislative Republicans are itching for a fight over the budget and how to pay for roads.
You get anywhere in the range and we'll have a good conversation and we can start, the negotiation process.
A new report shows how woeful Wayne County's system is for providing attorneys for poor defendants.
They've had over 30 years to change this structure, and they haven't. They could have added money to the system, but they haven't.
We'll talk about how HIV-positive women in Detroit are supporting each other and finding resources.
In order to address the multiple dimensions of HIV/AIDS, it requires that we address racism, it requires that we address sexism, it requires that we address deeply rooted inequalities.
All that and more coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Well, to borrow from the good book, ye shall hear of shutdowns and rumors of government shutdowns. Yes, the age-old political divide over money, how to raise it, how to spend it, it's rearing up in Lansing once again. All of this as the legislature careens towards its October 1st budget deadline. Well, today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer held a press conference to remind Michiganders that she's put forward a budget proposal, that she has a plan to raise $2.5 billion for roads, and that her Republican counterparts in the legislature, well, they haven't put up their own plan, nor reached a deal with her. GOP leaders have said that they're not sure it will take $2.5 billion more for roads. Well, here's Whitmer's response to that today.
$2.5 billion is what it costs. That's what it's going to cost to fix the problem. That's what I introduced in my budget because I know that the public is tired of politicians that lie to them or pretend that the problems aren't real when they're feeling it every day in terms of the bills they're confronting by fixing their cars to keep them on the roads. $2.5 billion is what study after study has said. It is really the number. And I know that if we don't make a meaningful change in the trajectory right now, that it will be $3.5 billion in just 3 years.
Here to update us on the latest back and forth at the state capitol is Chad Livengood, senior editor with Crane's Detroit Business. Chad, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, you reported this week in an exclusive interview with Governor Whitmer that she says she's not married to her 45-cent gas tax proposal to pay for roads. Today, she sounded committed to pushing for that plan, saying that it was the best plan. So how committed is the governor to this gas tax?
Well, she says it's the best plan. She says it's the most superior plan because it's, you know, this one simple vote. You know, Laura, she's framed this as one historic vote where you just vote to raise the gas tax. Where all these other proposals and possibilities, they involve multiple levers of government, different votes and budgets and rearranging money. And Governor Whitmer has contended, look, a straight gas tax increase is the fastest, easiest way to get there. And what she's really asking and sort of demanding now at this point from the Republican legislature is that they actually put out a plan, an alternative plan, that she wants a public debate about this. She wants the public to have some type of glimpse into what is the alternative to 45-cent gas tax increase. And so far, you know, the Republican legislative leaders have said, no, we're going to keep our policies or our proposals confidential. That was part of our negotiating agreement with the governor, and that's where they're at right now.
Right, because fast and easiest way is never the fastest and easiest way in the legislative process. Where do Republicans stand as far as a budget deal is concerned, aside from roads?
Well, now Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky is saying he's going to start moving the state budget separate from a roads deal. The governor has wanted the roads deal to be tied to this. The Speaker of the House basically has kind of indicated that he's going to do the same kind of strategy. And so now we're really kind of headed toward a showdown where if they send the governor a budget that she deems insufficient for transportation funding, she will have this, big, huge decision to make, whether to veto the bill and potentially trigger a government shutdown 34 days from now.
Right. She sounded pretty convinced that she would not agree to a budget deal that didn't include road funding, but she's also been through the legislative process and a politician for many years, and she is somebody who understands that sometimes backroom deals need to be made and that you have to make concessions. What are those concessions you think she might make in this deal process?
Well, today she made firm, and she made firm as well in my interview with her yesterday, that she was opposed to tinkering with the pensions of public school employees, and specifically how they are funded and the state's contribution to it. There's been some plans that have been crafted together by the West Michigan Policy Forum, a group of influential Grand Rapids area businessmen who want the state to take out $10 billion of bonds in order to pump into the pension fund and lower the cost overall up front. It's akin to basically refinancing your mortgage from 20 years to 30 years. And she has rejected that, citing a lot of advice from a lot of financial advisors. Senate Republicans, in particular the Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, really want that plan. They want the state to focus on that. It also would free up maybe up to $900 million in cash that could go towards road funding. And so she has panned that, but I think that's still out there as a possible bargaining chip. And then there's the other issues out there that relate to the rest of the budget, and whether you also go after sales tax on gasoline that this MIPSERS or pension plan kind of is tied to, removing that sales tax on gasoline so you don't shortchange the schools and cities. But like I said earlier, Laura, there's a lot of different moving levers and complications when you start trying to craft together a $2 billion road funding plan that doesn't just include a straight vote for gas tax.
Well, none of these levers are small ones to pull on anyway in this negotiating process. As they, the budget process usually is quite large and long. But does that mean that because we have now divided government that we're going to potentially see a shutdown by the end of September?
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There's obviously ways they can find some common ground still. And the other thing that the governor brought up to me that she's open to discussing, and there seems to be some interest among legislators, is having what is kind of referred to under the dome as a Proposal A style plan, where you would pass a gas tax increase that is unpalpable to a lot of voters, and then give them an option on the next general election ballot to either allow for that tax increase to go forward or to raise the sales tax as an alternative.
Well, Chad Lavengood, I think we'll be revisiting this conversation in a few weeks, so we'll talk to you then.
Thanks a lot.
Chad Lavengood is the senior editor with Crain's Detroit Business. Five years ago, hops were in high demand in Michigan, and more farmers started experimenting with that crop. But as beer tastes change and breweries adapt, many northern Michigan hops farmers haven't been able to keep up. This year, as more than a dozen hops fields in the region sit idle, their owners have either to wait for the prices to rise or close the farm for good. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner has this story.
The sun is shining bright on this late July day at a hop field in Omena. The plants stretch 20 feet tall. At the top of the lines, they are just about done growing. Ben Horney, a farmer, reflects on the view.
It's nice to see any hop field looking good, and this one is spectacular this year.
It's a bittersweet moment, because today, Horney is selling his equipment to another farmer, the final step in closing his own hop farm.
Work-wise, it was probably the only true passion I've ever had, professionally. But there's other stuff to do.
He had big dreams for the machine. He bought the large harvester from France, planning to do the stripping for all the hop farms on Old Mission. But after only a few years, all five of the hop farms there closed, and he was left with an expensive machine and no plants to run through it. He blames upheaval in the industry and the challenges of selling.
You can only take so many years of going from processor to processor and trying to find someone who can do it efficiently, and so many years of losing your butt.
Right now, the craft beer market is up 4 to 5%. but it's much lower than just a few years ago, when it was growing 18-20%. The farmer buying the equipment, Brian Tennis, owns a 30-acre hop farm and is a broker. His operation is doing well, so he's now focused on efficiency.
A few thousand pounds a day, and that's taking our time, but we can definitely run two crews and double that.
For a northern Michigan hop farm, Tennis's success is an exception. It's helped that he's a broker and able to sell his varieties as well as international hops to over 2,000 clients. But Tennis says he's made mistakes too and understands how others could get into trouble.
Farmers unfortunately picked the wrong varieties and it went out of favor, or there was just so much supply in the marketplace that it wasn't profitable to grow. So you'll see a lot of Ida farms around here that were growing Cascade or Nugget or Brewer's Gold that just, there's still a market for it, but the market value is so low, it doesn't make sense to keep planting it and training it.
Tennis grows 15 different varieties now to avoid that, which smaller farms can't do. Michigan State University's extension educator Rob Sarine says a few years back, brewers expected growth in the craft beer market that didn't happen. So they bought less and transitioned to proprietary hops that don't grow in Michigan. He says in order for the state's hops industry to stay alive, growers have to become expert salespeople.
The marketing and sales component and really differentiating the hops that they have here, to show brewers that they are different and something unique is going to be key.
For the farmers who called it quits, most aren't sure what they'll do next. Some have gone back to jobs they had retired from or changed to growing another crop. I pose the question to Horny.
Do you think you'll ever get back into growing hops, or are you done?
No, I lost too much money.
He doesn't want to say how much, but it's a $30,000 loss with this piece of equipment alone. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Nearly 90 years ago, Michigan's North Country was almost barren, and then came thousands of out-of-work young men.
If you're driving down the road in northern Michigan or in the Upper Peninsula, if you see those trees growing in nice straight lines, those were probably planted by the CCC.
The Civilian Conservation Corps and its legacy of nearly a half a billion trees planted in Michigan. That's coming up next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for Cindy to talk about our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
It is easy for we Michiganders to take the many trees and forests in northern Michigan for granted. But if not for a progressive policy called the Civilian Conservation Corps and plenty of hardworking young people in the 1930s, a lot of our beloved North Country might still look like leftover wasteland from the lumber baron age. Here now to explain is Hillary Pine. She's Northern Lower Peninsula historian with the Michigan History Center. Hillary, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So set it up for us. It's the 1930s. The Great Depression is just a black cloud over the nation, a lot of people who are unemployed. How did the Civilian Conservation Corps try to address this problem?
They were doing a lot. So the CCC, it operates from 1933 until 1942. It's right in the name. They're working on conservation projects. So here in Michigan, our big conservation need is trees. We need our trees replanted. After the logging era, a lot of our forests had been cut down. So one of the big things they're doing here in Michigan is planting trees. They're also really working on stream improvement. Another negative side effect from the logging era was that most of our navigable rivers had been absolutely devastated by river drives. So they're working on stream rehabilitation. They are stocking millions of fish into our rivers. They are working on soil conservation and erosion. And another big one is they are fighting forest fires. So up until this program begins, the state, the Department of Conservation at the time, they do have methods in place to combat forest fires, but it is still a big, big problem. When the CCC begins here in Michigan, that is their priority.
Well, it certainly seems that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt came up with a win-win, because men got work and Michigan got some incredibly important conservation work done. And I know that they lived in camps. So did we have a lot of camps in Michigan?
We had so many, and it depends who you talk to. And a big part of my winter was pinning down where all these camps were. But the number we came up with is 126. And it's hard to come up with a number because the camps moved around. Sometimes they would send 20 guys, let's say, to somewhere just for a month and set up a camp. Like here at Hartwick Pines State Park, where my office is, we had a CCC camp that was permanently here. They had structures. And one summer they sent a crew of guys to Otsego Lake State Park. But we don't consider Camp Otsego Lake a true camp, and we don't count that in our number.
Like a little satellite.
Yeah, a little satellite camp. Yeah. They moved around a bunch.
And interestingly, and probably not surprisingly, through much of the time of the operation, these Civilian Conservation Corps camps were segregated by race. But that is not how the CCC started. Early pictures show the camps were integrated, right?
Yes, they were. And beginning in 1933, when the program starts, FDR is pretty clear that he wants this program to be integrated. But very quickly, there are lots of issues. Even here in Michigan, especially in the Upper Peninsula, there are lots of stories of African-American enrollees who are in these predominantly white camps and predominantly white communities. And there's a lot of pushback from fellow enrollees, but also the local communities, because the boys, they're not locked into camp. They have Saturday off. They go to town. They go to dances, see movies. And especially in the Upper Peninsula, I've seen a lot of stories of African-American enrollees who face some pretty nasty things from local communities, you know, people confronting them very publicly, accusing them of crimes. And this is happening not just in Michigan. It's happening around the country at integrated camps. So in 1935, the director of the CCC makes the choice to segregate the camps.
And with that, when they segregated the camps, were the African-American workers then kind of on a lockdown? Were they allowed into town? Because that's a very sad thing you're describing.
Yeah, when we do segregate the camps in Michigan, all of our African-American camps were in the Lower Peninsula. We didn't have a single one in the Upper Peninsula. They tend to be pretty rural. Even if there was a community to go to, it would be pretty far away. They probably weren't going there super often.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. That was almost like social engineering, in a sense.
Yeah.
Now, I've read there is a Civilian Conservation Corps museum that's recently reopened. Tell us about that. What can people see and do there? And where is it?
Our CCC museum is in Ross Common. It's located in North Higgins Lake State Park. And it's actually on the grounds of Michigan's first tree nursery. The whole story kind of comes full circle. Our museum was built in 1985 by CCC alumni. They spearheaded this project in this museum. And we just spent all winter and summer working on new exhibits. And we just installed our artifacts last week. So it is open. And we're really telling the story of what was the CCC doing in Michigan? What kind of impact did this program have on the participants, on our landscape, and on local communities?
And to that point, are the fruits of their efforts still visible today, Hillary?
Yes. And sometimes it's very obvious, sometimes not. Sometimes you have to know what you're looking for. But pretty much if you're driving down the road in northern Michigan or in the Upper Peninsula, if you see those trees growing in nice straight lines, those were probably planted by the CCC. A lot of our state park and national park bathroom buildings and trails were built by the CCC. Sometimes you might have to ask somebody, hey, is that a CCC building? But once you've seen one, you start to get a feel for what they look like. You start noticing CCC work everywhere.
How many trees did CCC workers plant? Do we know?
Oh, my gosh. They planted so many. Here in Michigan, and this speaks to the the mass deforestation that happened and how much our land needed it, they planted 484 million trees. Nationwide, the program planted 3.5 billion. So here in Michigan, we were like the biggest chunk out of all the state of planting trees.
Fascinating, the history of the Civilian Conservation Corps in Michigan. And again, that museum is located at
North Higgins Lake State Park in Ross Common.
And we have been talking with Hillary Pine, who's Northern Lower Peninsula historian with the Michigan History Center. Hillary, thank you.
Thank you.
Treatment options for HIV have advanced by leaps and bounds since the AIDS crisis started nearly four decades ago. But these advancements aren't available to all people with HIV. While African-American heterosexual women have the highest HIV rates of any ethnicity, they are significantly less likely to be getting adequate care. Stateside host Cynthia Canty recently spoke with Jalecia Jolly, a PhD candidate in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. She studies how HIV-positive Black women are connecting and advocating for some more resources.
So what does the general public not understand about HIV and Black women?
The primary thing I would say, and that my research shows, is the need to address Black women not as medical subjects or sexual objects, but as holistic people, and figure out how to make interventions culturally informed, but also holistic, and addressing not the common things, which is use a condom, take your medication, but really figuring out how can you address some of the inequalities that really make it difficult for people to consistently take the measures to protect themselves and be able to cultivate a life that is meaningful and healthy in its broadest sense.
And is that a particular issue with Black women, or could most any group that has to deal with HIV and AIDS-related illnesses, could they make that argument?
So because HIV/AIDS is an epidemic of intersectional inequalities, what that means is that a lot of these issues are faced by other groups, but there are unique needs that Black women face that are unaddressed.
And what are some of these unique needs? Give us an idea.
Black women living with HIV/AIDS often have to make decisions about focusing on shelter or food or access to financial opportunities or employment opportunities. So what happens oftentimes is HIV can take a backseat to a lot of the sort of basic resources and life things. This includes childcare. This includes figuring out how to navigate romantic relationships, particularly for younger women who are living longer lives with HIV, given their recent medical advances, but are still figuring out how to manage life, family, medication, stigma, and all of the daily things that an HIV-negative person experiences on the regular.
It's a lot of plates to be spinning in the air at one time. That's
indeed
a lot of pressure. You wrote a piece for The Medium, and it was titled What We Can Learn from HIV-Positive Black Women. And in that piece, you point out that globally, AIDS-related illnesses remain the leading cause of death for women of reproductive age. Why hasn't there been more of a focus on HIV/AIDS and women, and particularly Black women?
That is a question that I'm trying to answer with my dissertation, and I think it's a very good question. It's a perennial question that never gets the full response, particularly because I think political will, financial resources, and just general research agendas have just not focused on women and also Black women. Since the start of the epidemic, I think much of the public health responses have and interventions have focused on men. I mm-hmm. think initially it was viewed as a disease that primarily affects men to a point where the CDC codifications didn't include the symptoms faced by women.
So there was much, much spotlight on the plight of men.
Much spotlight
and
on
rightly
the plight
so.
Of men.
I mean, it was when you think of those early years and particularly in the gay community, my word.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So it does, right.
And
so
it kind of, we stayed there.
We did stay there. We dwelled there, but we didn't expand it to think about the multiple ways and the multiple populations that it impacts, right?
Yeah.
And what it does then is take a crisis approach to responses to HIV. Mm-hmm. So what that means is if the groups that are considered not so-called, quote-unquote, at risk are deprioritized until there is an outbreak, as opposed to taking preventative methods or directing resources to a sort of more sustainable approach that considers cultural backgrounds or that considers the sort of differences within sexual communities, within groups.
So let's talk about with prevention methods and strategies and treatment strategies, what can we learn from HIV-positive Black women? What are local groups doing to take this kind of in their own hands?
So a lot of local groups, the ones that I engage are in Detroit, such as Gospel Against AIDS, as well as IFA Life in Kingston, Jamaica. A lot of these local groups are figuring out ways to use local knowledge about sexuality, about sex, about bodies, about healthcare, about myths about HIV and AIDS, to use that to design tailored programs that meet people where they are. And so what this can look like is going into clinics directly. And so going into these communities, engaging people directly. So that can be a condom demonstration workshop. That can be a one-on-one counseling. So that's the one thing that I see. Another thing that I see too is it's been increasingly important too for a lot of local groups to collaborate with other HIV organizing activists that focus on other populations. Much of that advocacy work was crucial to getting medication access in the late 80s, early 90s. That I would say that is one of the strengths that I've witnessed in my research, but also in as an HIV tester in Detroit, one of the things I've really noticed is the ways local organizing groups have really connected among each other to address some of these pressing concerns.
You know, it strikes me what you're saying is it's ground up and not top down, which probably gives people greater buy-in. If it's a neighbor looking at me and talking to me about this and trying to enlighten me, that means a whole lot more than somebody parachuting in.
Absolutely. In a conversation I had with one of the HIV positive activists, she looked at me and she said, you know, it helped that someone telling me about this disease was also someone who looked like me, who understood it, who went through it. And although we may not have had the exact same experiences, it meant something to have someone who looked like me tell me about this.
So just wondering, because you're involved in AIDS testing, you're doing all of this research, and I'm old enough to remember when we were all covering this advent of this. First, it was the gay disease, and then it grew. So we watched that snowball. We watched it. I remember the day that Magic Johnson announced that he was HIV positive. So it was very, very much top of mind for people. Has it kind of slipped to the background and been kind of crowded out by other issues?
Absolutely. I think a large part behind that slipping to the background has been because there's this narrative around the end of AIDS and around their medication, their advancements, so you can live long lives and you can live forever, and it's no longer the quote-unquote death sentence that it was when the epidemic first became an
issue. Look at Magic. That was, you know, early 90s, yeah.
But that perspective is largely false, and it doesn't reflect a lot of the experiences of people in under-resourced communities within the United States, particularly people of color. And importantly, in order to address the multiple dimensions of HIV/AIDS, it requires that we address racism, it requires that we address sexism, it requires that we address deeply rooted inequalities. So I think it requires that we address deep-rooted issues that really intersect to create the perfect storm that makes HIV/AIDS what it is in 2019.
And funding is a big, big part of the fight against HIV/AIDS. And we have seen federal support in the HIV fight dwindle. I mean, the president in his State of the Union speech this year, he talked about we're going to defeat AIDS. And 2 months later, he proposed the largest cuts ever to global HIV programs. And then in late 2017, the Trump administration fired all the members of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. So what is that doing to grassroots efforts like the ones you're studying that to combat HIV/AIDS?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the local groups that I engage have really suffered from this uneven distribution of wealth and public services in both the United States and abroad. And what local groups have been doing is finding various kinds of funders. And of course, it also involves finding ways to build collaborations with other institutions, with other groups, with health departments, also developing. It has involved a lot of alliance building to sort of fight back against a lot of the budget cuts, but it still has a disproportionately negative impact on the ways group access funding and the longevity of programs.
What has most impressed you, Jalicia Jolly, in doing your work and in researching and working with HIV-positive Black women?
That question hits home. As I've been doing this work, I've seen women evolve. I've seen their families develop. I've seen women die. And I've seen the continuation of the deprioritizing, the exclusion from important agendas, funding, and resources. But what gives me hope and what keeps me going is when I see the work that's done, that's intergenerational, that's done in creating psychosocial support spaces for women to connect across experiences, is when I see the ways women use their own voice to mobilize each other and to connect to another woman. It's when I see women engage with a variety of stakeholders that can be global organizations, local community groups, public health departments, governments, to demand resources to not just save their own lives, but to sort of continue a legacy of support, of advocacy, of community building, of life-saving work that is going to determine if we can end this epidemic at all.
Jalecia Jolly, PhD candidate in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. Her piece for the Medium is called What We Can Learn from HIV-Positive Black Women. Thanks for being with us, Jalecia. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Constitution's Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to have a criminal defense attorney even if you can't afford one. But a recent report details just how flimsy that constitutional right really is in Wayne County. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. The Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees that everyone accused of a crime has the right to a speedy and public trial, to have compulsory processes for obtaining witnesses in one's favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for one's defense. We are all guaranteed these things. But if you are poor and you live in Wayne County, and you are accused of a crime, you may not be getting the full protections of the Sixth Amendment. The nonpartisan and nonprofit Sixth Amendment Center examines state public defense systems. This month, they released a second report on Wayne County's indigent defense system. Cynthia Canty recently spoke with David Carroll. He is the executive director of the Sixth Amendment Center.
So after nearly a year in Detroit's courtrooms, gathering data and interviewing attorneys and interviewing judges, David, what is your verdict on Wayne County's indigent defense system?
Well, I think using the word system is a bit of a misnomer, because I think there's really not a lot of coordination involved with it. Basically, attorneys are paid by the event. It's a flat fee per event, and those rates haven't changed in nearly 30 years for the majority of felony cases. And so, as one attorney has said, the only way to make money off the system is by doing volume. And when you handle too many cases, that's when each individual cannot maintain their constitutional rights.
When you think of what you've studied throughout your career, where would you put Wayne County's system? And I'll use air quotes.
So if we go back to where Wayne County was a few years ago, looking at both the public defender side and the private counsel side, I cannot think of another major urban U.S. jurisdiction that I thought had a more problematic, dysfunctional indigent defense services.
So we're talking about the Third Judicial Circuit Court, largest one in Michigan. It covers Wayne County. So before we get into more details of what you found, let's talk about how the court handles felony charges against someone who's poor and can't afford to hire an attorney. So if I'm facing a felony charge, I would either get an attorney who's a public defender or someone who is a private attorney and appointed by the court. What's the breakdown? What percentage are public defenders and what percentage are private attorneys?
There's a Michigan Supreme Court order requiring 25% of felony cases be handled by the public defender. Historically, Wayne County has sometimes been under that and sometimes been over that. But what it generally means is when you're thinking of how a lawyer is provided to poor people in felony cases, the vast majority of people are going to get a private lawyer paid with these flat fee per event prices.
All right. So as you mentioned, you were on this program early last year with your findings about the deficiencies in the public defender structure, and you say there's strides being made to correct that. This new report is problems you found with the system of appointing and paying these private attorneys. So first, in Wayne County, is there any independent body that oversees all of this, any regular assessment of how well they're doing?
It's all handled in the judiciary, and that's not a Wayne County problem. That's a statewide problem in Michigan. Statutes currently say that the judiciary is responsible for setting up and overseeing the indigent defense services. I think it's a major flaw and one that the state will have to deal with. And indeed, the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission has promulgated a standard to the effect of getting the judiciary out of the indigent defense services.
David, there's a pool of private attorneys. Let's say I'm facing a felony charge. There's a pool of private attorneys who can defend me. How does an attorney get in that pool? And how experienced and well-trained do they have to be?
You don't need to have very much experience at all. In fact, if you're a new lawyer just out of law school and just hanging up your shingle and opening business, there's very little training that has to be done to allow you to get on those panels.
And how does someone get on that list of attorneys the court might appoint? Who decides that?
The judges.
Why is that problematic?
So when judges oversee public defense providers, there's an inherent conflict of interest because what the lawyer might have to do to get their next appointment or their next contract may be in conflict with what they need to do for their defendant. So let me explain.
Yeah.
Let's say there's a judge that's known to want to be done with court and on the golf course by 3 o'clock. It doesn't take that judge to necessarily say, don't file any motions in my courtroom, don't slow down the works, I want to be out of here at 3 o'clock. The defense lawyer just inherently knows that. And so it's coming into their decision-making process of saying, well, I could file this motion, but the judge would be upset with me, so I'm just not going to do it. So I want to underscore, it's not that judges necessarily have to be malicious towards the rights of indigent defendants. The system itself creates these conflicts that cause all sorts of problems and lawyers not doing what they're required to do under the Constitution.
So there's a statewide rule that's put forth by the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission to address this issue. What's in the rule, and are you confident it would be an appropriate remedy?
Yes. Yeah, so legislatively, under the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission Act, the MIDC is required to promulgate standards on independence of the defense function. They have promulgated that rule. It has not been adopted yet by the state. It's pending on that. But if passed, it goes a long way to removing the judges from any oversight or really any supervision of the lawyers that would be any different than they would for prosecutors. So if a judge sees poor practice, they certainly should call a supervisor and say, you know, this person's not showing up in time or all that. But they have to be devoid of the power to do something about that. And so I do think this is a major first step to fixing that problem.
All right, let's dive into pay and resources for these attorneys. Mm-hmm. And you certainly in your report take Wayne County to task for this event-based compensation. So help us understand, court-appointed private defense attorneys in Wayne County don't get a salary or hourly wages?
That's correct.
So paid for certain events that occur inside the courtrooms, give us an idea of what these events are.
So, you know, you attend an arraignment, you get a certain amount of money. If you go visit your defendant in jail, you get $50, but you're only allowed one jail visit per case. And so these rates have not changed for the vast majority of felonies in close to 30 years. And if you think about the cost of running a law firm, those costs have gone up considerably over that time. Think about the cost of, you know, everything from professional insurance to telecommunications to gas to get around to the courts and all that. So really, it isn't that things have held steady for all that time. There's actually been, you know, taking money away from the lawyer's ability to provide effective representation.
So lawyers are not compensated for the overhead costs they need to be able to be practicing lawyers and be able to defend me?
It's as simple as that.
I saw a figure somewhere. Was I right? A full day trial, $180?
Correct.
Would you call that a backwards incentive?
Well, it produces financial incentives and disincentives to do what needs to be done. So, for instance, there's a lot of talk about new technologies and the impacts on trials. So if you're being charged with something and you have, you know, lots of videotape from cameras around a neighborhood, you know, you get it in discovery, you might have to sit. It'd be ineffective assistance of counsel if you did not have yourself or an investigator go through all that tape to see if, hey, maybe my client wasn't there, or maybe someone else is there that's clearly looks like they could have caused the crime. So all that work of all that investigation, you don't get any money for. If you find something and you want to file a motion to challenge the discovery, you don't get money for that. It's almost entirely all in-court processes for which you get paid. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, you get $50 one time if you visit your client in jail. But if your client's out of jail and you conduct an interview in your office, you don't get any money for that. You don't get any money for interviewing family members or witnesses. It's a very inherently flawed system because it produces these conflicts for the lawyer who's struggling between what they have to do to put food on their family's table and what's required by our Constitution.
What would be an appropriate structure to be able to compensate attorneys, as you say, to be able to put food on the family table and to be able to provide good representation?
First of all, the system itself needs to be outside of the court. It needs to be an independent structure with a lawyer at the head of it who's not carrying a caseload and significant staff that's allowed to go around and do courtroom observations, look in case files, do things that supervisors would do to guarantee that the lawyers under them are able to handle the work and are in fact doing it. So that's going to be a new structure that's needed. And then on top of it, they have to change the compensation structure.
What would that look like? Like an effective compensation work structure that you see that's working elsewhere?
In the report, we note that the MIDC has promulgated compensation standards, and we agree with them. And they're saying that lawyers should be paid between $110 and $125 per hour. That's still far below what lawyers can make taking federal cases. And that's a rate that was deemed appropriate for the entire state. But you do think Wayne County, being an urban jurisdiction, will have higher costs associated with it, more serious crime. So it's not unusual for other jurisdictions of that size to be paying lawyers $150 or $175 an hour. So we think the $110 to $125 that MIDC appropriated is a great starting point for this.
A starting point. David, your report recommends two major changes. You've certainly touched on the need to eliminate the per event compensation structure and pay these people more. You also recommend that the MIDC, so the state, should administer and fund all felony indigent representation in the Third Judicial Circuit. Talk about that. That's a pretty dramatic recommendation.
It is. And one of the things I've told some policymakers in your state is that that recommendation really came out of the fact that we were asked to study Wayne County. We were not looking at other jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions may be just as dysfunctional or broken. We're not sure. But after doing two reports in Wayne County, we're saying they've had over 30 years to change this structure, and they haven't. They could have added money to the system, but they haven't. And if the state, let's say the reforms go through and these compensation structures are changed, the state's going to be pretty much responsible for about $40 million of money while Wayne County is only contributing probably around 10. These are just sort of round numbers, mm-hmm. so people generally get it. That's kind of like the tail wagging the dog. If I were a taxpayer and saying Wayne County's proven over decades not to be able to do this, why do we think giving them $40 million is going to change anything? And I do understand that that could cause all sorts of problems because other counties will say, well, why Wayne County and not us? But we can't make the recommendations in a vacuum. If we had studied a broader amount of counties, we may have come to a different conclusion on that. But without the independent standard having been officially adopted yet, we were left to say, well, there's only keeping things the way they are or the state taking it over. And that's why we made the recommendation we did.
David, are people in Wayne County being convicted of a crime because they're poor?
I certainly think there's a high and strong probability of that. I'm only hedging because we don't get involved in individual cases. So we can't say absolutely these 25 people were wrongfully convicted.
Right.
I watched the great work of places like the Innocence Project and know that they're uncovering these problems every day. So I will leave it with that. There's a high, strong probability that that's the case.
David Carroll, Executive Director of the Sixth Amendment Center. David, thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Stateside heard from a Wayne County spokesperson who said that they are actively working to address the issues laid out in the report. In the coming weeks, we hope to bring you a conversation with the official who is leading the county's reform efforts. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. What cities do you think of when you think of Michigan? Maybe Detroit, Grand Rapids, a tourist destination like Traverse City or Saugatuck. But what about places that are often overlooked, the cities that you've never been to in your state? Michigan Radio's web feature In Focus looks at places that deserve a little bit of showing off. Michigan Radio's Zaria Phillips is here to tell us about their latest stop, the city of Flint. Zaria, welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
Not bad. Why did you choose Flint?
Well, the In Focus project is not only about highlighting underrated towns, it was also about changing perception. So Flint is one of those places that I thought really deserved a change of perception. So when most people think of Flint, they think of the water crisis. So we wanted to hang out with a Flint resident, particularly a person of color who really suffered the brunt of the fallout from the water crisis, to show us what the city's really like.
So what were some of the highlights from your trip?
Really talking to the people, you know, Stepping Stones Falls is a beautiful waterfront park. And when we visited, we saw a lot of families out there with their kids. A lot of people were there to feed the fish. And we even met a resident, Gary Jones, who was biking along the Iron Bell Trail, which runs through the park. And he told us that he returned to Flint after traveling and living across the country because it felt familiar to him and it was home.
No, I mean, it's just like the old shoe, you know, you just, I mean, you know it. Yeah, you know it, you know, and you don't get caught up in the aesthetic issues, you know.
Well, Zaria, what do you want readers to take away?
Well, that Flint is thriving despite what outsiders think. India Young is the resident that showed us around. And she said that outside of Flint, a lot of people only think about the water crisis. So at the end of the trip, we got ice cream at a roadside stand and we talked to India about what some of the perceptions are that non-residents have.
I think people forget to look at all angles of the situation. There was a time when people would look down on Flint because of the water situation instead of, oh, dang, these people really don't have clean water. You know, it was like, these are the residents' fault that they don't have clean water. I don't mind it. I just like for people to be educated about it when they talk about it because I feel like this is our home. You know, we don't have control over that. And then a lot of times people say, well, why don't you guys just move? Do we have the money to just get up and move, you know?
You can find the latest installment of In Focus looking at the city of Flint. Go to michiganradio.org. Zaria Phillips, thanks again.
Of course. It was a pleasure.
Tomorrow on Stateside, as kids and parents prepare for the coming school year, some families are staying far away from the traditional classroom. We'll catch up with a woman who was homeschooled as a child without textbooks, and we'll find out how it prepared her for life as an adult.
I always would say that it's a lifestyle. It's staying curious. It's pursuing passions without hesitation. It's in my blood now.
What's it like to have been unschooled? That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks for listening.